So as 2021 comes to a close, we decided to reach out to our listeners to see what were some important questions we hadn't answered to date on the podcast. And I think the funny thing is, wasn't surprising to me though, is how many questions or issues were common amongst coaches, regardless of level. For instance, in today's episode, we talk about four things: what to do when a players don't get along, our staff isn't bought in, we feel pressure to win, and our fourth thing is what to do when a player quits. These four things are common questions, challenges that coaches face, the ones that Nate and I support through the TOC mentorship program. So these weren't really new to us. Like, we've walked with dozens of coaches through these challenges over the last 5 years. And so we're excited to share with our listeners some of our common advice to these questions. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin, the founder of TOC Culture Consulting, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week, our podcast shares practical tools and methods to grow as a leader and build a better culture. If you'd like to learn more about how we can help you outside of this podcast, head on over to tocculture.com. We've got free resources there, including the podcast notes, as well as online courses, and you can set up a call to learn more about our mentorship program.
JP, our first question here is one that I know many coaches are either dealing with or have dealt with at some time in their career, and that is this: how do you teach kids who obviously don't like each other to get along? How do you teach them to get along when they clearly don't like each other?
I love this question, Nate. I've gotten it a few times already this year from some other coaches, and my advice is pretty simple. It's what I do with my kids. I just lock them in a room and I say, sort it out amongst yourselves. No, but seriously, this is a great question because everyone faces this. And the reality is there's different personalities on a team, and, you know, personalities will clash. And I think it's a little bit ridiculous to think that everyone's going to get along or that we should force people to get along. So I've started to encourage coaches to take an approach that I actually have learned from my parent coach who worked with us early in the year. Is I have a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old. They often don't get along. And I think in the past, you know, if one said, hey, I hit, you know, he hit me, or she said this and she hurt my feelings, I would get involved and launch an investigation and force apologies and really, you know, try to sort out the situation. And my parent coach recommended to my wife and I that we just take a step back. And, you know, we choose, if as long as everyone's physically safe, to just pretty much kind of walk away if there's a bit of a conflict and see if they can sort it out actually amongst themselves. And if one of them comes to you and says, hey, you know, he said this or she did this, to say, okay, well, what would you like them to do? And they might articulate, well, I want him to apologize, or I want him to share the toy. And I really, really appreciate that, because that's what we've been doing. And I feel like we've actually been giving our kids reps. We'll say, okay, go talk to your brother, or go talk to your sister about that and let them know how you feel. And I think the same applies in coaching. Is it's ridiculous for us to get involved in little petty dramas of, I don't like her, or she doesn't like me, or, you know, he said this, or he did this in practice, or he's not passing me the ball. And then the day is just like, okay, well, what would you like them to do? Okay, go have a conversation with them about it, you know? And at most, maybe we're saying, well, you know, if they don't have the courage or conviction to do that, is to say, okay, well, can I help? And just maybe to offer some support to, you know, help walk them through how to have that conversation. Or I guess at the most, just be present for them when they have that conversation would be my initial suggestion here.
Well, JP, I can think of a couple of examples just off the top of my head. You know, one where when I was an assistant coach, there was a little bit of separation at the start of the year between our upperclassmen and our incoming freshmen, that a couple of them were going to play a lot in their first year in high school basketball. And we heard, you know, some rumors that the upperclassmen were complaining that the freshman point guard wasn't passing them the ball and they'd throw it only to their freshman teammates and things like this. And so, you know, as a coaching staff in our round of one-on-ones, we just took it head on, you know, and we just said to the upperclassmen, the junior, we sat down and we said, listen, we hear this is being said in the locker room. What's your perspective on that? Is that right? You know, and just, again, use some mirroring and some questioning to kind of get her to vent a little bit of her frustration and perspective. And then, you know, we would ask the point freshman point guard a little bit of her perspective and just shared with her, you know, not that we saw it and we thought it was definitely an overreaction and some jealousy and, you know, some of that kind of thing from our upperclassmen. But exactly to what you're saying here, our freshman point guard, to her credit, went up to those kids after practice and said, "Hey, I'm not trying to freeze you out. I'm sorry if you feel that way. I'm looking for you on the break. Keep running. And, you know, if I miss you, let me know. So next time I know where you're at." I mean, incredible leadership, you know, from a 14-year-old kid who's being accused of, you know, these things by upperclassmen. And that went a long ways. Just that willingness to bring it up and to talk about it and to acknowledge it and to find a solution was a huge step forward for us early in the season. Worked with another coach here this fall as they were getting ready for the start of their season, and also, you know, had some similar concerns about players that didn't get along. And that was kind of the reputation all the way through school up until high school, is that there's just this two groups on the team and they didn't interact very well. Nobody could really get them to play together very well. And so this coach did a preseason retreat, really just like a 4-hour thing, you know, offsite. And we just forced those players to interact with each other, whether it was through games or whether it was through competition. And the thing that ended up being the most powerful experience from that retreat was partner walks. The coach dictated, "Here are your partners. You're going to go walk for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is. Here's the two things I want you to discuss. What do you love most about playing basketball? And right now, what's the biggest challenge in your life that can prevent you from enjoying basketball as much as you know, would like?" And he said what happened out of that is all of these players and these kids that didn't understand each other realized that they all had anxieties about different things, parent pressures, you know, pressure to perform at a certain level. Was the game any fun anymore? You know, those sorts of things. And they really bonded because they shared some of those struggles. And now we're 6 weeks later, it's the closest team he's ever coached. And a lot of that just came from getting them to share their vulnerabilities and forcing them, not necessarily in a room and locking the door, JP, but putting them in an opportunity where they can understand each other better. And I think that was a great investment of time and something I would encourage coaches to really do their best to facilitate some of those connections and those collisions and those conversations that aren't going to happen naturally between two groups that are separated. But it doesn't mean that they can't come together without a little bit more understanding of each other.
Well, I think, you know, putting two players in a room and locking the door would be a great start to a Hollywood sports film, you know, of the guys that don't get along. But I actually like this idea around forcing the partners. And it's something that I've pushed for maybe more on the court or the field as well, too. I had an incident with a coach, you know, a coach had an incident with some players on his team this year. And it wasn't just like, "Hey, we don't get along and it's kind of annoying." It was like starting to become divisive with the team. And he did some of the similar stuff that you talked about there, you know, pulling them aside, you know, "What's going on? How are you feeling about this?" and getting their perspective. But it kind of finally kind of came to a head. And so he sat the two players down and said, "Listen, you're going to do everything in practice moving forward together. If we're partner drills, you're partnered. If we're doing one-on-ones, you're going against each other. If we're playing in teams, you're on the same team. And you're going to figure this out. You don't have to be best friends, but you're going to figure it out because right now you're starting to divide the team. And if this continues to be an issue after a, you know, week or two, then you, the two of you are just not going to be allowed to come back to practice until you can come and tell me that this has been sorted out." And so in that case, it was becoming a conflict and a cancer within the team. And he had to take a bit of a stronger approach. And you know what? It sorted itself out. They learned a really valuable skill, which is how to, you know, sort through conflict themselves, which honestly, we all need reps in.
Yeah, I think that's great, JP. And I think the last thing I'd say on this question, and then I'm going to tee up for the next one here, is that the worst approach to a fractured team socially is to allow the team to continue to be fractured socially. And so whether that's, again, being deliberate about creating collisions or it's about forcing conversations with players that aren't getting along, if you don't deal with it or address it or try to coach it in some way, it's not going to get any better. And most of the time it's going to get worse. And as it gets worse, the environment's going to get worse. The culture is going to be dragged down. People's enjoyment, you know, will be affected. Your play on the floor is going to be affected. And that's not always fun, and it can be frustrating. But figuring out where those fissures are, where the lines of demarcation are, if it's between upperclassmen and lowerclassmen, put them together. If it's between kids that played on two different clubs, as you said, put them together, right? And put them in a place where they can discover what they have in common and hopefully find a way forward. Now, the next question, JP, here that was submitted by one of our listeners, what suggestions do you have for getting my assistant coaches to buy in to what we're trying to do? Gosh, you and I have answered this question, it seems like a million times with a lot of the coaches that we've worked with over the years. This is one of the most common pain points for head coaches, is getting alignment and buy-in from assistants. JP, where do we begin?
Well, I would just, short answer, shorter response here is, leading your assistant coaches isn't completely different than leading your players. Leading is leading. And so the way that you build relationships with your players, by spending time with them, connecting with them as people, that applies to your assistant coaches. When it comes to the standards, how you want to do things, having non-negotiables, so that applies to your assistant coaches as well as supporting them. You know, and I think this is, you know, obviously a big challenge, and it really kind of depends so often on where the relationship is at. You know, I think the hard thing I think coaches struggle here is they're an adult. And a lot of times I felt like, as a head coach, like, well, I shouldn't have to get on them. I shouldn't have to remind them. I shouldn't have to come in there when they're not, you know, really engaged in practice, or they pull their phone out in practice, or they go off on a kid, you know, in a way that's totally not in line with our program, or they don't do the film review. Like there's this feeling like, I shouldn't have to lead you because you're an adult. And the reality is, I think we have to step up. We have to establish standards with our staff. We have to support them, and we have to enforce them. It is very rare where I come across head coaches today who have this assistant coach that's just that guy that does it all, is fully aligned, all on board, gets it all done all the time, and doesn't need you to lead them.
Well, JP, I've been really fortunate in my new position here at Mount Vernon that I feel like I have a staff of unicorns. I mean, guys that are exactly what you described there, that they are eager to learn, they want more responsibility, they give good feedback, they want to grow, they want to do, you know, run our systems at all the levels. They want to get the language aligned. And the more I talk to other coaches, the more unique I realize that situation is. When I think about the barriers to buy-in when it comes to your assistant coaches, one of the things that comes to mind, I remember listening to TJ Rosin on the Hardwood Hustle talk about why he doesn't talk to parents anymore. And TJ's a college coach, and he basically said it this way. He's like, look, I've been in basketball for 30 years as a player and as a coach. How do I communicate how I've evolved to a parent in a 15-minute meeting? Like, to get them to a place where they're really fully going to understand why we do what we do. He's like, it's not possible. So we just don't do it. We just don't even try, right? Well, if you think about bringing an assistant coach into your program, that same communication barrier and familiarity and understanding of one another exists. But obviously with an assistant coach, you can't just blow it off and say, well, I'm not going to talk about it. We're just going to do it my way, right? And so it becomes a challenge for them to understand why do you do what you do, and for the head coach to understand their philosophy and their perspective on certain things that may cause conflict. And there really isn't a shortcut to that other than just walking through it together, right? And having some healthy conversations. I think as you're talking about that, and if I'm working with an assistant coach that I just sense they're just not on board, and that may manifest in little things like they don't show up for the extra team dinners, or maybe they're not at open gym, or maybe they just kind of sit in the background and practice and things that they don't necessarily believe in what I'm doing, whatever it might be. I'm really thinking about trying to identify what Chris Voss would call the black swan in this situation. So in his book, Never Split the Difference, you know, Voss talks about, as a hostage negotiator, when he's working for the FBI, trying to free people that have been kidnapped, trying to identify what is the fundamental issue here. Is it about a religious, you know, belief? Is it about a financial thing? Is it a political thing? But they really couldn't make a lot of headway with the terrorists until they identified the key motivator. And I think so often with assistant coaches, we bump our heads in, you know, we have conflict or we have misunderstanding But we don't do the work to try to figure out what is the fundamental thing that's missing here. And that could be, I'll just give you a simple example. Maybe your assistant coach wants to be a head coach. And every time they show up and they have to work for you, it's just a reminder that they're not a head coach yet. And so if I know that, then I can communicate, I can help them, you know, I can try to share more information with them to help prepare them for their next opportunity. I can leverage that black swan to my advantage. But if I'm not aware of it and I don't empower them and I don't share the why behind what we're doing, then that just continues to frustrate them because they don't feel like they're growing toward the thing that they want to accomplish. I think the other thing that goes along with that, JP, is a lot of times the frustration from an assistant coach is I got nothing to do. Coach runs practice, coach runs a film session, coach does all the talking before and after the game, and they don't feel like they're heard. They don't feel like they have a job, you know, that matters. And so, you know, we just had a conversation with Alan Keene and Simon Turner here yesterday. And one of the things that stuck out to me was they were talking about players, but I think this applies to coaches too, is that it's one thing to listen and to feel like you're heard. It's another thing when the head coach makes a decision in response to that, that validates that input. So in other words, if I have conversation with my staff about whatever, philosophy on baseline, out of bounds defense, is that something that I could give away to make them feel heard and valued so that they're more likely to give me useful feedback in the future? If I just listen and keep doing my own thing all the time, I think that becomes frustrating for assistants and it makes them more likely to disengage rather than to feel valued and motivated.
Yeah, I love you bringing that piece up there at the end, because I remember my wife telling me a story. She had worked at Amazon for years and in their fulfillment centers. And she said the quickest way for a leader to lose credibility with the people was for them to not take action on suggestions and to not act quickly, you know, and to not act in a timely fashion, right? If they say, oh, okay, I got you, but they don't actually make the change until months later, you know, or they don't ever make the change, then just people stop losing credibility, people stop sharing, and people stop wanting to collaborate. So, you know, I would say one other thing here in this whole staff buy-in, or, you know, staff, you know, actually being engaged and doing a good job. And that is, I think the early in my career, I had kind of the mindset of like, the more the merrier. You know, extra bodies, more coaches here, it's going to get more stuff will get done. And I think that is actually inaccurate. I think I've recommended to some coaches, like, if you can't find people that are going to have some sort of growth mindset, you know, they may not have to be where you are on your journey, but if they're not going to make an effort to try to grow as a coach, to try to take a more transformational approach, or just to even be engaged within the practice and not have their phone out, or whatever type of, you know, knuckleheaded behaviors we sometimes see our assistants do, like, if they're not going to even try, then you're just better off doing it alone, because you've got there as a potential negative role model. They're more just one more person that you have to manage and lead. And so I feel like that would be another piece of encouragement, is don't just believe the more the merrier. Sometimes you get a lot of people in there and all of a sudden nobody just wants to do, all they have is a bunch of opinions, you know, and they don't actually want to do any work other than just talk about things.
And here's one more thing that I often share with coaches in situations like this, is that a lot of times the collision is between expectations, unmet expectations on both sides of the table. The assistant coach thinks their job should be X, Y, and Z. The head coach thinks the assistant's job should be A, B, and C. And there's no overlap in the Venn diagram, right? But oftentimes, again, they don't understand each other. And so I encourage them to sit down and have the head coach write, what's the job description from your vantage point of the varsity assistant, for example, and have the varsity assistant say, all right, write down your job description. What would be ideal for you? And then just sit down and compare the list and figure out where there's overlap. And eventually, I think this provides clarity where both the assistant and the head coach can recognize either, yeah, we've got enough common ground, we can find a way to make this work so that both expectations are adjusted and met. Or it becomes really obvious really fast. This thing is probably not going to work because I'm not going to be satisfied if you're not doing these jobs. And the assistant coach isn't going to be satisfied if I'm asking them to do those jobs. And so it's just a way to get everything on the table and create a pretty healthy conversation. Now, JP, the next question out of the hopper here is, how do you handle the pressure to win. Sometimes that pressure is internal. It comes from ourselves. Sometimes it's external. It comes from parents or the players, the administration, the community, you know, bringing a team back that was really good the year before. There's lots of sources for this potential pressure, but we know how that weight can feel. So JP, how do we handle that pressure to win?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, we just had a podcast about, you know, how to learn how to lose. You know, we just did a few episodes on that. And I think, you know, we shared some important concepts in there. But I would take this a little bit step further. Right? And here's something maybe coaches could practically do as some sort of journal activity or reflection activity. And that is to just take time to imagine your life without coaching. And I know for many of us, our life is, you know, very much centered around coaching, and coaching is our passion. It's our joy. But we need to know who we are, even when we're not a coach. We need to look at the other areas of our life that we can be grateful for. And I think just imagine that worst case scenario of, okay, what happens if I lose and they run me out of town? Is my life really going to be over? Or do I still have things in my life to live for? My family, you know, and the friends and maybe other hobbies or interests that we have? Because the reality is, like, the worst case scenario of you losing your job and never getting back into your the passion of coaching is probably not realistic. Like, there's plenty of coaching jobs out there. Guys are getting fired left and right, you know, like it's and there's not a lot of people signing up to be coaches these days, I feel like. So there's plenty of opportunities out there. But even if the worst case scenario happened and you could never coach again, who would you be and what would your life be like?
JP, over the course of my career, I've had the privilege of coaching a number of teams that played under a lot of pressure. You know, we've been preseason number one. We've been defending state champs. We've brought back everybody from a 500 team with a lot of expectations, you know, the following season. And if we're being fully honest here, that's kind of a sucky thing about sports and just the emphasis on winning so much is that it can complicate our relationship with the game, with the team, with our family at home. And we've talked about those things here over the last couple of weeks. The best approach that I've found in those situations is to find ways to remember what brings me the most joy in coaching. So when we've been number one and there's pressure to get back to the state tournament, win a state championship, you know, our focus as a team and my focus as an individual was, I don't know how much longer this ride is going to last. You know, if we get knocked out in the next round, it's going to be over for this year and for this team. So I want to make sure tonight we've got this regional final or this state quarterfinal game that we enjoy it, that we enjoy the opportunity to be together because we love each other and because we love what we're doing. We love playing together, love coaching this team, and making that my first priority before anything else, before the scout, before the, you know, advancing, whatever it might be. Like, that's where I start. And that's a very deliberate thought process. When I was going through some mess at Linmar, you know, in year three, and there's all this expectation, we didn't play well early in the year and the seat's getting warmer and warmer and warmer. You know, I had this stubbornness that I wasn't going to let, you know, this group of parents or disgruntled players or whatever it might be, take away my joy. Like, if I got to go back to practice the next day and the kids that were bought in and the kids we had good relationships with, I got to hang out with and coach basketball, which is my favorite thing to do, I'm just not going to let them take my enjoyment of that away. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't feel differently when you have that heat. But I think when we recognize what is it that we enjoy most about the process or the team or being around young people or scheming the game or whatever those things are that are most rewarding for you, and putting that at the top of your list, being thankful for those things, maybe journaling about those things, maybe jotting on your practice plan, make sure to enjoy this today. I think that can help insulate us in a bit because it focuses on the thing that's most important first. Now, our next question, JP, is a different spin on a question that we've talked about on the podcast before. And that is, what do you do when players quit? And we've talked in episode 106 about how do we handle players that want to quit? But this is after the fact. When a player leaves the team in the middle of the year for some reason, how do you handle that?
Well, I think if you've been part of the process, like we talked about in episode 106, and you've walked them on this journey, obviously you continue to have a relationship with that person because you've supported them through this decision. But I think this question is more geared at the player that just quits all of a sudden because they're not getting the playing time they want, or they're upset about you holding them to a certain standard. And my recommendation to coaches is pretty simple in this regards. Let them go. You know, we'll miss you. You know, the old Southwest Airlines story, you know, of Herb Kelleher, you know, we'll miss you. In fact, actually, you may not miss them. You might be just all better off and you may be so happy that they've gone, right? And you've probably, hopefully you've done everything you can to support that player and coach that player. But the reality is not everybody is for you. If you want a special culture, you've got to let people go and you've got to be, you know, selective. And some people can be really highly selective. Other people have to just be, you know, have some sort of baseline selection here as far as, you know, the cultural standards, you know. Not everybody can be super highly selective, but we still need to be selective. And not everybody is for us. So don't run after them. Don't chase after them. But I would say we could learn from it. You know, if there's something that you could have done better to have provided a better experience and support that player, you know, try to figure those things out. But don't beat yourself up over it. You know, at the end of the day, you got to move on. You got to coach the team that's in front of you.
I think there's a couple of different perspectives on this, JP. I think one, you do need to address with your team, are things going to be different without Johnny here? I mean, if Johnny was a starter, who gets the minutes? If Johnny's coming off the bench, who takes that turn? You know, if there are adjustments that the team is going to have to make, I think being as straightforward with that as you can, as quickly as possible, just helps the team to, you know, feel comfortable. All right, coach has a plan for this. We know how we're going to move forward. And in some ways, it helps to provide a clean break. In other words, instead of saying, boy, I don't know if Johnny's going to be back on Wednesday. Is he going to play Friday? Here's the plan. Johnny left. We respect Johnny's decision. You know, we support him. We hope he's at some of our games. Here's how we move forward. And we just move on. I think that can be a healthy approach for your team. I think what's hard about this as a coach is that there's still a perception that when players quit, that's a negative reflection on the coach or the program. Like there must be something wrong with the coach, or there must be something wrong with, you know, the team or the environment or the culture or what have you. And I just think that's a little bit of an outdated perspective in this sense. When we look at players leaving, you know, for whatever reason, and we blame the coach or we blame the program, I think the reality in most cases is probably 85 to 90% of the time, it's a playing time issue. You know, they're out for the sport because they want to play. They're not playing. And they don't know how to handle that because that's disappointment, right? And they don't want to feel bad about not being in the lineup or, you know, not being a starter or not being out on the floor. And so rather than learn to deal with that difficulty, and maybe that's an emotional challenge as much as anything else, they flee. And they're allowed to flee. They just run away from it, you know, so that they don't have to deal with it. I don't want this to be a cop-out for coaches to not take responsibility or to not do a little self-examination about why players are leaving. But I don't know that it really is a condemnation of the program as much as it is a lack of ability to be able to handle some adversity and find a way to add value, even if you're not on the floor.
Well, I don't want to go on a rant here, Nate, but I think it's also a bit of a reflection of where we are as a society and just understanding that this is the world that we coach in. We don't need to complain about it right now, but you know, the parents aren't oftentimes encouraging players to play through disappointment of not getting to play. They're not encouraging their son or daughter to, you know, respect the coach's decision when it comes to enforcing standards or a high standard of work ethic and practice, if that's the reason that they leave. And so I just think in that sense there, you know, it's just a reflection of our culture. And we got to be, you know, understanding of that.
And JP, I know we've mentioned this before, and you say this all the time, but when your culture and your expectations and your standards are cemented, people know what to expect. They know what their role is going to be. They know what's asked of them, and they can make a decision. Is that what they want or not? And ultimately, that's the sign of a strong culture and a strong program, is that it's so clear players can self-select themselves out or in because everybody knows what the expectations are. And so I know that's not often seen as a strength, but I can think back to my own experiences when we've had players that have chosen not to be part of it because they're not going to be happy with their role or, you know, the standards that we have. It's best for everybody. I don't need malcontents to be out and, you know, the kids that can do it. That are bought in, they don't want to be distracted by that either, right? So in some ways, when you get to that point, everybody wins when they can make their own decision knowing what's expected.
All right. Now, in next week's episode, we're going to unpack four more challenges: coaching in a blowout game, working with parents who make strategic suggestions, how to coach kids through disappointment, and climbing the coaching ladder as a transformational coach. All some issues and challenges I think every coach faces at one point in their career. You're not going to want to miss it. Also, if you appreciated some of the insights into the questions, you might want to explore the TOC mentorship program this year. It's a lot more than just hopping on a call with Nate or I and asking us questions or bringing to us a challenge you are facing, though a sounding board is one of the valuable aspects of it. We've got a host of resources beyond our online courses to help you systematically implement your culture while also having a community of other coaches around you on a similar journey. While at the time of the release of this episode, we're currently full, I know in a couple months we'll be having some spots open up to work with new coaches and add new members to the TOC community. So be sure to add your name to our waiting list or schedule a call in the near future to learn more about the program and to see if it's the right fit for you.